Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tate Modern. My name is Marco Daniel. I'm the curator of public programs. This is Patricia Bickers, editor of Art Monthly. We're here to welcome you to the second in our series of Talking Art interviews with artists that we are co-hosting together. For today's interview, Martha Roslin will be talking to Ilona Blaswyk, former head of exhibitions at Tate Modern, now director of the Whitechapel Art Gallery in London. Roslin's work centers on everyday life in the public sphere, often with an eye to women's experience. Her work deals with issues ranging from homelessness, gender stereotyping, and advertising, to the representation of war in the media. Among her most widely known works are the pioneering videotapes Semiotics of the Kitchen of 1974-75 and Losing, A Conversation with the Parents. Her photo text work, The Bowery, in Two Inadequate Descriptive Systems, is considered a seminal work in conceptual and postmodern photographic practice. Also widely noted are her series of photo montages Body Beautiful or Beauty Knows No Pain, addressing the photographic representation of women and domesticity and Bringing the War Home, House Beautiful, addressing the imagery of the Vietnam War, and that series, of course, was reprised in relation to the war in Iraq. She's also exhibited recently at Münster, at the Münster Sculpture Projects, and, well, we are very, very pleased to have her here today in conversation with Ilona.
Needless to say, I'm very grateful to Art Monthly and Tate Modern for giving me the privilege of talking with an artist who I've admired for many years and who never goes away. She keeps popping up. Because, in fact, the first time I came across Martha Roslin's work was in 1980 as part of this exhibition at the ICA when I was a baby curator. And it was a very remarkable series in a very remarkable show, which, looking through it over the last few days, the work in it looks fresh and relevant today as it did 27 years ago. What that opens up for me, anyway, is a particular theme, one of five themes I'm going to talk to Martha about today. And they are, roughly speaking, modes of address, in which I think she has really been create a sort of paradigm shift, if you like, in the way that art, the kind of methodologies that she uses. We're going to talk about space. We're going to talk about public, domestic, and institutional space. And, of course, gender and labour. These are all things which are woven throughout her work. But to begin at the beginning, there was an exhibition at the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin last year called The Studio, and curated by Jens Hoffman and, a curator at Hugh Lane. And, of course, when one thinks of the studio, one immediately, I think, thinks of the Pollock-esque, splattered, hermetic space of the Protean painter. And by contrast with this was Martha's studio, which actually looked very ordered and very cerebral, I would say. What do you think your presentation says about your methodology?
That presentation was a highly idealized picture of my space, which of course is messy and horrendous, but the basic, honest, and true element is that it was an office. And even though my actual workspace is a horrendous, messy, and despicably disordered office, it's still an office. And I have to say that one of the shockers to me as an artist is I used to say that no one ever told me in art school that I would be a secretary to a mythical artist named Martha Roslin, but I would say further that nobody ever told me, because they could never have imagined, that I would be the digital assistant to an artist who literally no longer exists. I was interviewing an assistant at some point in the spring, and the person said, So would you say that 90% of your work is done at the computer? And I became quite indignant until I realized that that was probably an underestimate. So the fact that my studio with its rows of slides and tapes and so on nevertheless is centered on a computer, I think, and of course the radio, the indispensable radio, I think that's what the Hugh Lane conveyed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's unfortunately, I mean, this is a dangerous thing to say, particularly in the States where the art market has dictated that everybody be a painter, and a dumb one at that these days. But I am from the deathbed generation, as we were saying, who gets interviewed at these talks. It's, you know, the deathbed generation, or close to.
The work that we saw in issue in 1980 was a series from 1974 called Tijuana Maid, and it took the form of postcards. So that was a kind of pretty early form of address for you. What led to that decision to use that mode?
Well, to follow on to what I take to be your basic question about the studio, is that my practice is, of course, to a large degree rational, and even, one might say, text-based. Even if the outcome is an image, there's still a basic framework of textuality. And I guess I was sitting in some graduate class in the early 70s and thinking about ways in which artists address the public, because the topic of the moment, of course, was artists attempting to seize control from the gatekeepers of institutions like this one and the magazines and so on, and trying to get rid of the middle person and address the public directly. And my friend Eleanor Anton had done her Boots series, and we were living at that point exiles from New York in a very small town called Solana Beach, California. And I was thinking about postcards as a mode of address, and then I realized that I would like to do a serial postcard novel that had no images either, so that it really bypassed not just the actual modes of distribution of art to the public. Sounds like packages, but also the expected, which would be that it would be based in images with any kind of text being the incidental or the descriptive. So that was what I was thinking, that I would like to produce a series of false autobiographical works, or at least starting with one, about my subject of the day, which was women and food. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. Cobbled together a mailing list from Nowheresville and sent...
Yeah, who did you send them to?
Well, partly I asked for Ellie's list, partly I sent them to a bunch of alternative galleries, essentially, curators, younger curators in all over the country, really, and to friends. And somehow that first one, not Tijuana Maid, but McTowers Maid, Budding Gourmet, sorry, got picked up by the Village Voice. And then it turned out there's a recipe network, which, by the way, is alive and well online. And people there wrote to me, and so actual people collecting recipes and who had no interest or involvement with art also were on the mailing list.
But it strikes me as a kind of viral strategy that, you know, it comes unannounced through your letterbox.
Spam.
It's spam, exactly. Do you think that the internet is an analogy for that today?
I do. You may be surprised to know that some people were offended by the appearance of a postcard in their mailbox unbidden, and saw it as an intrusion. And I said, well, why is that more so than a flyer trying to sell you furniture? And of course they had no answer, but I guess because it was too close to something they might have been interested in.
Yeah. Also because postcards are always celebratory. They're always about a holiday or some, you know, news from somewhere pleasant.
With a picture.
And this was quite the opposite.
Yeah.
And I think its shock rested in that. Mm-hmm. Also, of course, of telling the story of an invisible person.
Right.
Really.
Right.
Then moving on to, you know, I think one of the most important things in your practice and most influential has, of course, been your lens-based work in the sense of both your use of photography and video. And really, I suppose, one of the best-known works have been, which have also been shown at the Whitechapel in Inside the Visible, have been your use of collage, of appropriation, and then photographing the collage, where you juxtaposed images from Vietnam with domestic interiors. Can you say something about how you got to that methodology and why?
The methodology of montaging?
Yes, yeah.
And which part of it exactly?
Well, it's so different in a way from Dada collage, for example.
And yet it's a direct outgrowth of Dada. Actually, surrealist collage. Max Ernst was my first model on this, and a California artist named Jess, who cut up what subsequently we would call clip art and made elaborate tableaus. What interested me about those practices as opposed to the Dada photomontage, of which we saw very, very, very little in the U.S. in the mid-60s, was the rational space, that they weren't simply flying off in, at all angles. And I was very taken by the idea of giving a viewer a place to stand in. And therefore, the photographic became the obvious choice because photography tends to suggest the possibility of a real space, if you don't just cut it up and ignore the idea of perspectival relationships. I was very much interested in the picture of the world that we propagated that suggests there were numerous worlds, none of which quite intersected with one another, or if so, in some arcane way. I wanted to suggest the unity of the world and therefore our at least putative responsibility for what went on within it. And that in particular related on the one hand to the space of representation in which women were inserted, which we disclaimed as being actually about us, but also of course the notion of a war elsewhere on others' territory, which we could say was happening over there, outside somewhere. So that was my aim.
Also, in a way, they're both the sources you use. You could imagine, you could regard them as kind of quote unquote, not quite ready-mades, but found images. So was there something about authorship there as well, that you took what was already out in the world?
Even the postcards, you had to look very hard to find my name anywhere. It was just a tiny little rubber stamp on the back of the card. Authorship was also, of course, in question in the 60s and how we arrived at it. And I think pop art very much revolutionized the notion of who created what and what the nature of a work of art might be in a culture so dominated by corporate culture and culture industry.
But again, there's a difference, I think, quite a radical shift from pop. You know, one thinks of, say, Richard Hamilton or in Britain or Oldenburg and so forth, that their relationship to the everyday and of mass culture, popular culture, is essentially, dare I say, kind of apolitical, in that, except in that its refusal of the kind of great, you know, idea of art and masterpiece and the juxtaposition with art, abstract expressionism, and that with your work you intersected something unpalatable and shocking, a woman whose arms have been blown off, who has stumps in a deluxe sitting room. I mean, that jarring effect, I think, takes it away from these ravishing, beautiful, but kind of hilarious interiors.
Well, First, I never accepted that pop was apolitical, and in fact, I still have some long screed that I penciled, about the absurdity of trying to read pop as though it had no deep political meaning just because the people who made it said so. I thought that was absurd. And clearly, pop was about the nature of the world and the social world. That's its subject. Therefore, it could hardly refrain from being political, though that was the rap. But I also would like to offer something of a gentle corrective to what you said about what I put together with Watt, because I think that frequently people think of these images of, let's say, the Vietnam War, and give them an expressionist content that they simply don't have. And I'll get to why I think that is in a second. The image that you appeared to be describing was of a young girl, a 12-year-old girl, who was missing part of her arm, and you can see it bandaged in the foreground of a black and white, it's actually the whole thing is black and white, photograph of quite a nice lounge. But everything in these images is, some will appear eventually, I think, is quite still. And in fact, I was an anti-expressionist. I was hoping that you would think about it. But it's inevitable that when we see these confrontations, especially the first time, that the horror comes from us. And that's a legitimate emotion, but I don't think that horror is my genre. I really prefer to stay quite cool, even to, as I said, the point of stasis, rather than showing blood or some kind of moment of shock. I'm not sure I answered your question, though.
We also have here a video, Prototypes, God Bless America. I don't know if it's actually ready to play. Because I wanted to move on now to the use of video.
It is 1 minute long. If, I don't know, did Marco take the little bag? He's going, no, yes, hands waving. Yes, you have it. Don't say no. We could.
We don't have it.
It's in the British Museum bag. In that Berwick Museum bag. Sorry.
When did you first pick up a video camera?
When did I first pick up a video camera? I didn't, actually. It had an entirely different origin. I was a grad student at UC San Diego, University of California, San Diego. And David Anton, who was my professor, suggested that he had made friends with the guy named Charlie Cox who ran the medical. And this was the medical school facility where they were doing something a little bit new, which was videotaping autopsies and operations. And it was in the basement of the medical building, and he suggested to me and three guys that we might want to learn to do video, which actually, of course, was already in our world practice because this was 73. So I went and I learned to use a studio camera and a switcher and to study the electronics of waveforms and to read the waveform monitors and so on. And a few years later, David Ross, who was the young video guy at the Long Beach Museum, he was the director, said, Martha, I want to give you a show, but you have to make new tapes. Here's a camera. And he gave me a Hitachi 3030, which is a big, clunky, not very good, but sort of state-of-the-art color camera, and I made four tapes in 2 weekends, and that was my first use of, I got a tape from an artist collective in New York and did Semiotics of the Kitchen. Mm-hmm. That was a Panasonic. What? Ta-da!
Okay, thank you.
It's 1 minute long. Loud, please, I guess.
America!
is, of course, on a loop normally, but I think I'll spare you.
What year was that, Ned?
What?
What year was
06. That? 06. And it was actually part of a show in which I had a 3.5 meter high blue prosthetic leg in the middle of the gallery that slowly kicked, and a number of other invisible sound fields that you walk through. As you probably know, the traumatic amputation of limbs, particularly legs, is one of the signature wounds of the current war in Iraq because of the improvised explosive devices, that the opposition uses. And I also saw it as a kind of a I have a work about war called Fascination with the Game of the Exploding Historical Hollow Leg, which I'm using legs as well as a metaphor for kind of phallocentric emptiness and, of course, missile power. So you have here a child's toy in a home environment, and it sort of opens to something larger. And it's, I guess, derisory.
In terms of the presentation of video, had you, where did you want it to appear? Was it on a monitor in a gallery, or had you ambitions to get it on television? What was its kind of route to the public?
Well, in the beginning, there were only monitors, TV sets. And then there was some artist cable, very little in the U.S., but there was some. And even in the mid-70s, my work was on various artist cable networks. The public broadcasting service showed some work, but I knew it would not show mine, and that was pretty much a given, especially once I started using appropriated imagery. But it was sort of in the Alan Capra model of small audiences, one after one after one after one, rather than to a mass audience. And that the thing about video was that it was cheap, and cheap looking. It had no standards, so you didn't have to make things that looked like high production value film, and it was easily transmissible in various ways to various audiences who tended to be quite eager to see it, actually. Although most of the audiences were of artists and art publics, that was by no means always the case. There were frequently other groups that were interested in seeing things, which, especially once there were VCRs available, the small players, could be seen anywhere.
And then I'd like to play Semiotics of the Kitchen, because that's a kind of different aspect of the work, which is really about performance and when you put yourself in front of the camera.
And low.
Could we run Semiotics of the Kitchen, please?
Apron. Bowl. Chopper. Dish. Egg beater. Egg beater. Fork. Grater. Hamburger press. Ice pick. Juicer. Knife. Ladle.